You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Coming up on this week's show, the Spectrum is reborn again.
Sonic CD as you've never seen it before.
And we go inside the world of Capcom and Square with Yoko Shimomura.
The Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, one of their titles you absolutely have to check out is A Guide to Japanese Role-Playing Games. Now, this incredible book explores the history of JRPGs from the 8-bit origins through stuff like Final Fantasy and Pokemon, spanning a massive 652 pages and covering more than 600 games. You've got all the subgenres in there as well, RPGs, roguelikes, dungeon crawlers, and also features on the music and art as well, and it looks absolutely gorgeous, like all of their books. So check it out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 444, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And it is our favourite time of the week, every Friday, when us geeks get together and bring you up to speed on all the big happenings in the wonderful wide world of retro gaming and technology, and of course bring you veterans of the industry onto the podcast every single week. That is what this podcast is all about. In fact, we love doing that so much, we're prepared to travel to get the best names in the industry on this podcast, aren't we?
Oh, yes, yes. And this week's interview is absolutely amazing. You know, we did it in Norway, and it's a live recording from the show. So thanks so much to the guys at Retro Mesa, which was an awesome event, for getting us to host and do some panels, which we're going to be playing out on the podcast in the next few weeks.
Yeah, starting with today. Now, this was actually the first panel that we did, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed on the Saturday morning when we got there, and it was a packed audience as well, wasn't it? And actually, it is something different to this podcast, because obviously, I mean, you know, we've done coming up on 9 years of this show now, which is insane. And, you know, we love to cover all aspects of the history of gaming, but always we've had a bit of a problem being an audio podcast, getting on people that don't speak English. So obviously, you know, we cover a lot of the Western side of video games, but there is a whole other world. You know, Japan is such a big player in the history of gaming. So the fact that this is our first Japanese guest on the podcast, I think is definitely a big deal.
Yeah, we've had a Japanese guest in our book, but not on the actual podcast, because that's, you know, in written form. So in spoken form, it's a bit different. And it's going to be interesting to see how this one works, because we've never done an interview with a translator there before. But this was absolutely epic. It was Yoko Shimomura, and you may know Yoko from Street Fighter 2, which was her first kind of independent project she did as well. She was on Samurai Sword, which was on the Famicom Disk System, which is quite fascinating. We talk about that. Final Fight as well, which is another game that you may all know. And then she went into the world of RPGs. So, you know, Super Mario RPG, Parasite Eve, which is just, the music on there is just absolutely insane. And then Kingdom Hearts. So, you know, she's a classical pianist, and a lot of that piano and emotion goes into her music. And I like to think in the interview, we asked some questions that people usually wouldn't ask, relating it to, you know, Western music and kind of Euro game scene as well. And you know what? She was so open and so friendly that it's a really good interview. And I think it's quite a long one, this is. So you're going to get a bit extra on the podcast.
Yeah, because the audience were, I mean, we could have done like another hour with her, I think, couldn't we, with all the audience questions?
She's done so many, you know, we've only mentioned a few titles and it just goes on and on and on. And she's still working today on some amazing stuff.
You know, you made a good point there because, you know, not wanting to go, you know, too behind the scenes of how the podcast works. Usually when we interview guests, we just write the questions up and, you know, we basically do them in real time. For this one, we had to send the questions over in advance. So I was a bit like, is this going to be kind of strict and on script kind of thing? But actually it was the complete opposite, wasn't it?
Yeah, because we do the questions, but then we hold them back from the guests. Yeah. So it's kind of like a surprise, and then it doesn't feel too rehearsed, where on this one we had to send them quite far ahead, you know, and get approval on certain questions and stuff, which was different. But you know, the translator did an absolutely amazing job as well, conveying her emotions, and also you know, trying to work around the English language, which is quite hard when you've got two things going on at the same time.
Yeah, she did an amazing job. And like you said, she was so open. You know, we quickly went off script, didn't we? Instead of the questions started coming in, like you said, the crowd had loads as well. So,
oh yeah, and it's not simple stuff. You know, I was talking about high fidelity audio channels and all the kind of usual nerdy stuff that you expect from the Retro Hour.
Yeah, and of course, you know, like you said, her attitude to kind of what was happening over in here in Europe as well. And she recently did a collaboration with Chris Hulsbeck as well, didn't she?
Yes. She did a huge concert with Chris Hulsbeck, and Chris was at the event as well. So it was really good having the kind of contrasts of two different amazing, renowned musicians worldwide.
Yeah, so no other podcast gives you this kind of access. So you're going to really enjoy this one. Yoko Shimomura, legendary Japanese video game composer who soundtracks so many of our favourite games growing up. She's going to be our special guest, recorded live at Retro Mesa in Norway on the podcast in around half an hour from now. Now, like you said, Ravi, it is quite a long interview, so let's get straight to the news this week. A lot to cram in, so we can do this in like 20 minutes or so. The big headline, of course, that has been everywhere this week, and from what I understand, this news was a little bit premature because I think this was listed on a retailer's website a few days early, and then the news quickly got out there, and Retro Games Limited are like, yeah, we're doing this next. It's the next big thing. But they didn't have all of their kind of press and PR stuff prepared yet. So it kind of snuck out there a bit on Friday. But this is that Retro Games Limited, of course, the company behind all of those great little mini computers, you know, the C64, recently the A400 Mini, the Atari 400, and the A500 Mini as well, has revealed their next system, which is a ZX Spectrum, simply called the Spectrum.
Yeah, and I guess this was, they'd released a timeline, like an updated timeline. They had one previously, which was talking about, you know, these consoles are going to get released at this point. They talked about an Amiga as well, a kind of full-size Amiga, because they've done one. But this was like the mystery console then in that timeline. And then this like just accident happened with the retailer. And now we all know it's a Spectrum.
And the thing about this is a lot of people have been saying kind of another one. And we were having that conversation before we started recording, weren't we? That it was like, you were like, how many of these now have come out over the last decade?
I was aware that there's quite a few Spectrum clones that have come out, because I've seen quite a few. And then also, of course, there's the Spectrum Next, which is an amazing kind of, it plays all the original Spectrum stuff, but it's kind of like the future vision of the Spectrum. And I know that's in huge demand. So I'm guessing also, you know, this console is going to benefit from some of the Spectrum Next titles coming out, that they might release them as Next specific, or, you know, to work on your classic Spectrum as well. So there might be some new ones getting added into the library, which is good. But it does come with 48 games already.
I'm interested in Joe's take on this as well, as you know, because, I mean, none of us were Spectrum guys, but obviously, you know, you're quite into your minis. What do you think of this?
It's cool. I was actually moaning a little bit last week when they announced the Atari 7800 Mini. Yeah. And I was saying about the price of them. So this is going to be £89.99. And I think the 7200 was going to be like £130.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit more affordable, which is nice. It seems a little bit more in line with the mini console hype of kind of like, you know, the late 2010s where we were getting, you know, all the SNES and NES minis and stuff.
Before the price of everything went up.
Before the price of everything went up, which is nice. Interesting, obviously, that it's just called the Spectrum. And that it will play 48 and 128 model games via a USB drive. I think it looks cool. Like you say, it's before, you know, we're not too familiar with the Spectrum. It's before my time. But the game line looks good.
I hope the keyboard's a bit of an improvement.
Yeah, we were talking probably about that last night, weren't we? Yes.
Most people on the Hangout last night were like, I hope it's not. I hope it's as bad as the original.
Yeah. Obviously has those iconic squishy rubber keys. So it'll be interesting to see what they actually feel like.
To me, that is a big headline of this, because all of their other kind of mini consoles don't have working keyboards, but this one does.
Yeah, which is really cool. Does it say anything about actually being able to program on it at all? Does it say anything about that?
Well, that has been something, they haven't actually said that from what I've seen so far, but I've seen a lot of people saying that that is kind of a feature they really want on there. Because if it's got the keyboard, then it would make sense that the basic interpreter would be accessible as well. But obviously on a lot of the other systems, like, you know, the Amiga, the A500 Mini, for example, it didn't have the operating system on, it was just a games launcher. So that kind of remains to be seen.
That kind of, I'm sure the operating system on the Amiga was a legal thing. And, you know, looking on this, it's not ZX Spectrum. There's, I think Sky owned the rights to that, and they actually let them have them for the Spectrum next. Looking at the top, obviously, there's no Sinclair. There's Retro in a kind of big, you know, push-out bit.
Where the Sinclair logo is.
Yeah, which I don't quite like, actually. I think it should just say Retro Games Limited or something, but just Retro. I'm stuck on the top of the Spectrum. But I don't know if it'll have the OS. That's a really interesting thing.
Yeah, because I mean, because this hasn't really officially been announced yet, before we started recording, I went onto Retro Games Limited's Facebook page to see, you know, because a lot of people have been saying on Twitter and stuff like, and in the comments on articles, can we program our own homebrew games on it? But literally the only thing they posted over the weekend was, yep, this has been prematurely announced, and yes, we are doing it.
And it will be modded in 10 minutes, won't it, to be able to play?
Well, I mean, yeah, you know, that is the thing, whether or not it's kind of included out of the box or not. I mean, like all of their systems, you don't need to jailbreak them or anything. You can load your own titles on via USB, and it took about, a week for people to get Amiga OS booting on the A500 Mini.
I'm wondering, will they do any add-ons with this as well, like a thermal printer or something? You know, that could be quite cool to do.
Little till roll printer. Yeah, that would be awesome. But yeah, I mean, in terms of size as well, because I mean, the rest of their systems have obviously been, you know, miniaturizations. But the original Spectrum is a very small system anyway. So yeah. I'm wondering, it's a bit hard to tell from the pictures of the box that we've seen so far. And, you know, there's no real side-by-side comparisons next to an original Spectrum that I've seen so far. But obviously the original Spectrum was tiny, and I imagine to incorporate the fully working keyboard, I wouldn't be surprised if it's pretty much an identical footprint to the original system.
It does look a bit smaller, just looking at the USB-C input of, like, the sizes of, you know, I'm just going by, like, how big the HDMI looks and how big the USB port.
It's quite smart, though, actually, because I was just thinking, how big is it? But, yeah, there is a picture of the back of it with all the ports. I think that looks right. I think it's a little bit
could
smaller.
Could be quite cute, yeah. Right.
Well, I guess in terms of, you know, if they can shrink it a bit and make it still usable, it's less plastic, isn't it? So it's going to be more affordable.
I guess, will it interface with some of the joysticks and stuff? Maybe if you have some weird USB adapters or something.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only way. It's just USB. There's no kind of, you know, traditional Atari-style joystick ports on there.
I guess it doesn't come with how to be a complete bastard.
No, that is not one of the included games from what I've seen.
Stuck on the back of the box.
there's no Jet Set Willy on it either, which some people have been raising an eyebrow over.
Alfreda's and Monty's on there.
Yeah, Manic Miner's on there, The Hobbit, Head Over Heels. So, you know, a lot of the big ones are on there. But the thing about these is you don't really buy them for the included games because you can put your own on anyway.
Yeah, School Days and Saboteur as well, the remastered one.
And, you know, they're available all over the internet if you want to get Spectrum files. They're not hard to find. And it works with all the, you know, the popular formats like TAP, TZX, PZX, SZX, ZAT, SZA files. So it's got a lot of file type compatibility on there as well. Emulates, like you said, the 48K and the 128K Spectrum. It can output 720p HD via HDMI with PAL and NTSC. One thing I like about this is you can actually play it in original 4x3 mode.
I'm just imagining all the YouTube videos of, like, I hooked up my USB tape drive to the
yes
to the new Spectrum, or, you know, I guess you might even be able to get the iPhone and just hook that up straight away and then play audio through there.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it can. It says you can play them from a flash drive. I'm not sure whether it's got like a tape loader
or mode support for external accessories.
But it's got four USB A ports on there, so flash drives and joysticks, not even plug in via it. There's no actual joystick or controller included with this, and no power supply in the box either. You've got to use your own, but it comes with the cable. Like, you know, it's pretty standard these days, isn't it? Although one day I've got a feeling we're all going to run out of power supplies because nothing comes with the plugs anymore, which is a bit of a worry. But yeah, looks really good. Like you said, $89.99, which I think is a decent price. Pre-orders are available now, and they're expecting it to be released on the 22nd of November, which sounds like a long way away, but when this podcast comes out, it's September tomorrow. So we're nearly into that time of year now, shockingly. So always nice to see new new retro hardware coming out, though. And obviously Retro Games Limited have got a great track record in this as well, so I've got no doubt that it will be of high quality. So looking forward to that. Now, this is very cool to see. And as someone who, you know, it's weird because we were talking about this. As our resident Sega guy, Joe, is it true that you've never played Sonic CD? Did you say that once?
Who said that?
Is that not true? Did I imagine that?
Who's telling lies?
How dare they?
How dare you?
Slander.
It's the type of thing that I would then go, yeah, no, I've never played it. But how dare you? No, I have played it. Of course I've played it.
Okay. I was a bit worried then. Yeah. For some reason, that was in my mind. But yeah. But basically now, anyone can play Sonic CD if you have a Mega Drive and a flash card. Without the Mega CD very soon, by the looks of it. Someone's actually ported it to the standard Mega Drive.
Yeah, so this is part of the Sonic Hacking Contest, which I think we've mentioned before, which is essentially a contest for hacked Sonic games. And there are, if you go down that rabbit hole, there is a lot of hacked Sonic games.
Oh, yeah, this is for all the Sonic games as well. It's not just like the old school ones, you know.
You've got
like Sonic Adventures and Origins and all that getting
hacked. All sorts, absolutely all sorts. And, you know, we spoke not too long ago about people porting Sonic Mania to the Wii and to the Wii U and stuff like that.
That was the one you haven't played properly.
That was the Sonic one. I've not played Sonic Mania properly.
I knew there's some bigger mission there.
But Sonic CD, it's being ported and comes out in September. And it's being ported by a small team. It looks pretty cool. So it looks like they've kind of had to... They've decompiled and disassembled the original code and then rebuilt it up. And what's really cool about it is they've rebuilt it up using the Genesis, Mega Drive, keep saying the Genesis, the article, but the arrangements. So they've got the same arrangements of like code and the arrangements for the music and everything like that, but then built it within Sega Mega Drive, debugging, if that makes sense. I know I'm butchering it there. And what we get is a very fast, you know, playable version of Sonic CD by the looks of things. For me, the only difference is it just looks a bit duller.
A bit washed out the colours.
Yeah.
Palette-wise,
it is quite washed out. And I never really, I don't know, like the Sega CD, was it that much better in terms of like the colour palette and stuff? I'm trying to think.
Could the sprite scaling and stuff like that, couldn't it? I'm wondering
fast,
though, because,
you know, it looks like it plays well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether they've captured this off a real Mega Drive. Maybe that's why it looks like that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think you might be right there. So, yeah, a little bit washed out. Sound-wise, this clip we've got, I don't think that is the Mega Drive chip.
I've looked at the comments and they've said basically the audio hasn't been done yet.
Right, okay.
So what is on the little trailer they've released is basically just one of the CD audio tracks from Sonic CD.
That's what I assume.
But they're saying on the first build, the music on it will probably just be from Sonic 1.
Oh, okay.
But then they're working on actually basically rebuilding the tracks from the CD audio of Sonic CD using the Mega Drive's Yamaha chip, and that will come at a later date, hopefully, when they've had a chance to do all that. So in the first release, it'll probably just be Sonic 1 music.
It was one of the only games that I bought like on my mobile repeatedly, Sonic CD. And that was, you know, my experience at playing it. And it's a hell of a title. Really, really good.
Now, we've covered the news part of it, but for me, this is probably what you're thinking of. I was never a big fan of Sonic CD. Like, I always found when I played it through, because I recently played it through on Sonic Origins, which was the, you know, the recent one they did about 2 years ago, where it had like the original kind of Sonic Mega Drive CD games on there. And I just found whenever I play Sonic CD, you just kind of get stopped in your tracks. Like as soon as you build up any sort of momentum, I always just found I hit a wall straight away or I went back through time. Like, and I was like, oh, right, okay.
The time warps,
the time warp thing happens. Yeah. So I could never really get any momentum. And I know that's something like a lot of people moan about when you actually
get stuck in a few like endless loops. But then you have to time it and get out of them. But
So I personally always enjoyed Sonic 2 and Sonic 3 more than CD. But I do like the style and the graphics of Sonic CD. And obviously, the anime intro. You know, the anime intro.
Which I doubt that will be on this.
I doubt that will be on that as well. But that would be mind blowing if we got that on there with a 16-bit Yamaha chip version of Sonic Boom on there.
Apparently, it was released on Windows in 1996.
Oh, wow.
Really bad. Really bad port. So.
Yeah, really.
Fair enough.
One thing I like, though, is if they are going to do the music, they've said it will be the Japanese / PAL soundtrack, not the awful North American version they did, which had really crap music. So, I mean, I think it's cool. I mean, in this day and age, there's no real reason to have this because, you know, if you've got you need an EverDrive to play this on your Mega Drive anyway.
Yeah.
And the EverDrives can support Mega CD games
anyway
directly, unless you got one of the really early ones. I guess they couldn't. But again, it's one of these things of, you know, don't ask why, just
go with it.
Just because they can,
They did it. Exactly, it's a hack that they've made.
Which is very cool to see. And I always like, you know, people doing previously unthought of things. I mean, if, you know, this had to come out back in the 90s, then not that Mega CD sales were that great anyway, but I imagine they may have been even less if this was floating around. But yeah, it looks very cool to see. There is a little 45-second trailer. If you want to check that out. And then, like you said, full release, September, which I guess any day now. So I'll put that in this week's show notes. Now, one thing I love doing is checking out media from back in the day. I've actually been watching, you know, it's a regular thing of mine to watch old episodes of The Computer Chronicles on YouTube or old episodes of Bad Influence and Games Master. Can't get enough of those, you know. Once I've finished the run, I'll generally go back and start them all over again. One thing, though, that doesn't really get as much love as the old TV shows is old radio broadcasts. And that's always been a bit of a shame because occasionally I'll go through like an old magazine, you know, if we're researching guests on the podcast or looking for ideas, I'll flick through some old mags from the 90s and I'll often see headlines about, you know, computer or video game radio shows.
You know, I found the weird corners of the internet with, like, you know, the proper nerdy ones. I have a real good appreciation for some of the older radio shows and stuff. You know, there's quite a lot that I used to, I think it was like Tales from the Unknown I used to listen to, Hancock's Half Hour and stuff, and they've actually archived them and put them online in some collections. So I think there is a little bit of love for it as well. You've got to hunt and try and find these things.
Well, I'm more talking about, you know, old computer shows because there was, you know, computer and video game shows that were broadcast on the radio. There's some of them on like Astra Satellite and stuff back in the 90s that, you know, the archives are completely gone.
Yeah.
I think some of the guys from some of the old Sega, like Mega Magazine did like one on some random Astra channel apparently. But I think Paul Monahan was talking about it on Facebook and I asked him, like, is there an archive of these? And he went, no, they've gone forever. So that's the thing about radio. It comes and goes once it's broadcast. That's it, a lot of the time. But it's always nice to see when radio shows get recovered, particularly one from such an exciting time in computer history as 1983 to 1986. Now, this was a show that was called The Computer Cafe that was broadcast on several radio stations in the Central California area. And, I mean, you think of that time in computing, they were interviewing people and attending shows, you know, chatting to people like Timothy Leary, Bill Gates, Jack Tramiel, even Douglas Adams.
It was a
new
thing, computing. You know,
It'd only been around a few years.
New emerging industry.
Very early days. I mean, to me, this is kind of it's, you know, pretty much what the Computer Chronicles was doing on TV. These guys were doing on the radio.
Yeah.
But it turns out these shows were actually recorded back in the day. So it wasn't a live show, which obviously, in terms of recovering them, makes it a lot easier because every episode was recorded on reel-to-reel tape format. And it was thought that, you know, for decades, these tapes were lost. And then an archivist, his name is Kay Sevets, he actually managed to recover some from a recent property sale. And he actually set up a GoFundMe to get these digitized. So now you can listen to 53 episodes of it on the Internet Archive.
This is awesome because, like you said, you know, you've got Bill Gates, you've got Jack Tramiel, you've got Douglas Adams as well.
Yeah.
You know, some legendary people there, and they're all at different phases of their life. You know, this is early Bill Gates. This is before the huge successes and, you know, world domination. It's quite interesting to hear the difference of, you know, how they were and how they viewed things back then.
Well, I listened to the Jack Tramiel one today, and it is an interesting time. It's 85, this one was recorded, and obviously it's when Tramiel had gone to Atari, and he just launched the ST. And they were chatting to him backstage at a computer show. So I'll play you a minute of it, have a little listen. I mean, the audio quality is actually really good because obviously this was on professional reel-to-reel tape. It wasn't, you know, recorded on cassette
Which, you know, I'm glad they're archiving it now because it has a limited lifetime. Yeah,
normally you play those through a couple of times and the magnetic coating of the tape falls off. And
I've still got some of Dale Winton's radio shows, radio not to give as well, reel-to-reel, so I need to archive them.
How on earth did you get hold of those?
I don't know.
Or shouldn't we ask?
I think there's someone with a reel-to-reel of Dan Wood's first radio show somewhere.
Oh, yeah. No one wants to archive that one. But let's have a listen to Jack Tramiel then backstage at a show in 1985 that was broadcast on The Computer Cafe.
When I was manufacturing editing machines and IBM was manufacturing mainframe computers, which they still do, you had to pay a few million dollars to be able to buy a computer. You had to be a very large company to own a computer. My aim was from then, and I've accomplished it, to take away that black box image, to make computers available to everyone which wants to buy one, especially to the youth. So my competition loves to come up with good products, but still sell them for thousands of dollars, like the IBMs, like the Apples, and with no question, the technology which Xerox, the Xerox Star, and the Apple Macintosh, it's a very, very fine type of operating system, like GEM, which makes it easy to operate, faster reaction, better graphics, better sound. And what we have done is brought the machine down to a level where the masses can afford to buy it. Where my competition is selling for thousands, we sell it for hundreds.
You know that line on The Simpsons?
Say the line, Bart!
I was waiting for him to do the...
For the masses, not the class.
Yeah, for the masses, not the class. He didn't, though, unfortunately. But yeah, great to hear him, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's one thing about that. I mean, it was very... When they've done the digitization, it probably won't come out on this podcast because I think I'm probably, you know, the post-processing that'll fix it. But it's very left ear heavy. So, yeah, when you're listening to it, it was only coming out my left speaker.
It's just classic stereo separation, Dan. That's so true.
Yeah, they haven't gone through and fixed it by the sounds of it. They've just kind of literally recorded it as it was, which, you know, is authentic, I suppose, but that's easily fixable. But there are 53 episodes of it. It might only affect that one. But at the moment, they're on a bit of a hunt as well for anyone that's got any more episodes.
Well, this is awesome, like, and I think, you know, we should put all our stuff on archive.org. I've already seen there's a few Retro Hour episodes there as well. So, you know, once we're grain old and dying, we'll put them all on.
They're already grey and old, hopefully not the last part. Yeah. But yeah, that's very cool to see. So lots of listening there as well. One thing that's great about the archive.org page is that there's an RSS feed on there. So you can put that into something like, you know, Apple Podcasts and listen to them as a podcast.
Oh, wicked. That's
which
a good
is quite
idea.
Nice. So if you want to check that out, plenty of listening of, like I said, 53 hours worth there from back in the golden age of Silicon Valley and, you know, the early days of computing. So I'll put that in this week's show notes if you want to check those out. Now, this next story looks very cool, and this is something that was a long time in the making. 18 years to produce this. Someone has done a King's Quest VI demake.
This is a fan, Brandon Curie, who has demade King Quest VI. Hair today, gone tomorrow, which I think is great. Classic Sierra game. I haven't actually played the King Quest games, but...
Yeah, you know what? Weirdly, because I'm a big adventure game fan. Yeah. I haven't either. That's a big admission.
Oh, man, I thought you were going to... Well, I knew Ravi would have, but I thought Dan was going to say he was a big fan of these, if you being a fan of, you know, Monkey Island, etc.
Weirdly,
I've there were so many Quest games though. Like I played it briefly because I was a police quest man, but then you also had Space Quest. You know, there was King's Quest. You could do them all. You know, but I think the particular interest of this is you need to look at it and go, why was this remade? Why has it gone down to the older style and become a remake? And it's it was a changing point in Sierra. So Sierra at first had, you know, the typing interface.
Yeah.
You're typing commands, walk left, open door, all of this kind of stuff. And that was done in the basic style. Then they had a period where it changed to Creative Interpreter Engine, which basically removed the text. And it had, you know, classic point and click style interface. And they did that with Police Quest. They did that with Space Quest as well. And all these games suddenly, they even got to the point with Police Quest that they started redoing the original ones with this new point and click interface. So it was like, you know, an update, and they could kind of re-release it. And it was during the CD-ROM time as well. So you had audio on some of them. Now, what this guy's done is he's taken it back to the old school Sierra interface, that title, which it's never been on before. And, you know, I think this is a way that a lot of people would want to play it because it's something they're used to.
I think it's really cool what he's done, you know, to take it back, you know, a game engine, essentially, hasn't he? So it looks more like the early...
An earlier generation. Earlier
generation, the earlier King Quest games, which I think is really cool. And it must have been so painstaking to kind of like draw this all up, you know, pixel.
I guess he's had to recreate every single scene. And I don't know if he could have done that with AI or something, but I think he's probably done it by hand.
He's done it by hand, I imagine, because he started it in 2006 and then finished it, obviously, this year. The thing that got me was Activision currently own the King's Quest series. And I was a bit like... Because it's taken him 18 years of working on this, and he's putting it out for free. You know, he's not expecting any money for this, and he's made it very clear it's nothing to do with the original creators. It's nothing to do with King's, like, actual King's Quest people. It's not to do with Activision. But I am so worried for the guy that Activision are going to take it down, because to have worked on it for so long, and I think, Ravi, you're right. I think he's hand-drawn it all, and then he's had to program it all in himself to get it.
Yeah, and good job. He's recreated the look of it, you know. It may not be to the Sierra like complete polish, but well done. And you know, having to interpret those scenes as well and the text and know what to put in there correctly, hell of a job.
Absolutely, it's huge. But yeah, fingers crossed they just let this one slide and go, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, because I mean, someone that's dedicated 2 decades of their life who loves your game that much,
yeah,
that they've gone to do this. I mean, yeah, hopefully they'll... I mean, it is available now, but as we always say with these kind of things, grab it while you can. And as we always know, things never really vanish from the internet. So, I mean, like I said, I've never played a King's Quest game before, and that as an adventure game fan is a huge omission in my gaming history. So this might be the one that I try first. I might give this a try and check it out. You know,
from the beginning, Dan, and go all the way through, I suppose, on this engine.
Yeah, I like the look of this, though. It looks... it looks really...
An old school VGA PC.
Yeah, and play on a CRT. Obviously it's the engine that Leisure Suit Larry, the original one, was built on, with the typing interface at the bottom. Yeah, I think it looks really, really cool. The fact that he's actually stuck with it.
Yeah.
Something he started in 2006 and he's finished it, I think, is commendable in itself. So, like I said,
it's huge because it has multiple endings in the game as well when you have to choose your own path, and, you know, so it's massive, massive effort.
Yeah, that is an incredible achievement. So, if you want to get that, that is available for a free download now. Now, it obviously has been a Gamescom in Germany this week. A few friends of mine have been out there, said it was a really good event. Obviously, it's a big one, isn't it? It's like 5 days long.
Yeah. Gamescom. Huge as well. Just massive event.
Yeah, so a lot of retro exhibitors have been there too. And there have been a few headlines from Gamescom in terms of retro this week. This one kind of stood out to me though, so I thought this looked quite cool. This is a company called Retrobit, who are working on what appears to be basically an updated Sega Saturn Virtua Fighter stick.
This looks pretty cool. Well, it looks really cool, to be honest. And obviously the Sega Saturn, famously 2D powerhouse, was pretty much built for 2D fighting games. You know, it was the first kind of console where it was like pretty much arcade perfect, you know, Marvel versus Capcom and X-Men Children of Atom, all these kind of games, Street Fighter Alpha. So, you know, the fighting stick is very, very at home on the Sega Saturn, and it looks very similar to the Sega Virtua stick.
The Japanese one, isn't it?
Yeah, similar to that. The PAL / American ones were more in line with the black sleek kind of like, you know, Mega Drive.
I've got one of those and the buttons are all mushy. They don't feel like arcade buttons.
Oh, there you go. So I've not played with one of them. I've played with the Virtua stick before and, you know, they're really, really nice clicky buttons and stuff. What's interesting about this, though, they've shown off this prototype. It looks beautiful. It's got this classic, it's kind of a mix because it's got the classic green buttons, but then it's got the black sleek kind of like American style of the Saturn and the Mega Drive. Kind of the base is black and everything, which is really cool. But it does say this is subject to licensing in the small print.
So they haven't cleared it with Sega.
They haven't cleared it with Sega yet. So concept-wise, really, really, really cool. And I hope it does happen. But in terms of, you know, whether they get licensing and stuff, I mean, Sega, they're okay. They're pretty cool with these kind of things. I'm just trying to find out now quickly how much the original Sega Saturn fighting sticks go for, because I know fighting sticks can get pretty expensive.
Yeah, they go for about, looking at eBay, 90 to maybe 120
quid. Okay, what, for the virtual
yeah.
one?
Yeah, a lot of these got to import from Japan, though, as well, if you want that model of it.
Interesting.
The Western release, there's one. They're quite varied, looking on eBay. There's one for $41.99.
Yeah, but...
And there's one here for $119.99. Obviously, depending on condition, I suppose.
That's the thing, but yeah. Oh, yeah, 90, I'm on eBay now. Yeah, I can see, you got to get it imported in, but around £100 if you want the good one, if you will. So I'm interested to see if they do make this, what would the price point be? Because it's one of them, because sometimes these sticks come out and they can be very expensive when they've got all those original kind of like, you know, parts or based on original parts and stuff.
You know, I think it's obviously the logo at the bottom that's the issue with Sega, because it says Sega Saturn arcade stick. And to be honest, the logo looks sick because they've done it in a holographic kind of style, so you know, wherever you move it, it changes color and stuff, and I think that's really cool. But they could probably just take that off and do some other branding, you know?
Yeah, no doubt it will come out, but yeah, interested to see what the price point would be. You know, I've got a feeling it'll probably be a similar cost to just kind of getting one imported, but you have it here, you know,
and it's new.
As new as well,
you know, it's retro a bit, they kind of know what they're doing, you know.
So
yeah, I think one thing we haven't mentioned about this is it works with different interfaces. You can use it wirelessly.
Oh, okay.
As well, yeah, and actually includes apparently two adapters. So you can either hardwire it or you can use it wirelessly. It's got a USB adapter and one that works with the Saturn. So basically, a little receiver that you can plug in the Saturn and play it wirelessly. So that is one advantage it's got of the original one, that, you know, you're not tied to your system.
Oh, okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, so, and like you said there, Joe, with these kind of things, I mean, price-wise, it is always a bit of a concern before they come out, and obviously, they probably won't be manufacturing, you know, 80 million of these. So the limited run of them often affects pricing. But, you know, arcade parts are readily available. You know, it doesn't mention whether they're genuine Sanwa parts or whether it's some kind of cheaper alternative. But either way, I imagine to get something that feels as good as the original Sega one back in the day probably won't be that costly. Mm. You know, the parts are all out there. Like you said, Ravi, it's whether they can get that Sega licensing and how much Sega want to charge for that as well could be a consideration. But yeah, I don't think that's essential. If they took the Sega logo off there, it wouldn't change a stick.
The Suga fighting stick.
yeah, reverse it, yeah. So, ages fighting stick it would be, wouldn't it? To take this one. The Sega thing back in the day.
Oh, yeah. I see. Yeah,
you get me. No word on release date or anything as yet, but if you want to have a look at the pictures of it from Gamescom, I will link those in this week's show notes. All right, patrons, stand by. We have got a couple of extra news stories for you, because we do that every single episode for our amazing patrons. A little reminder, if you'd like to support the podcast, not only do you get the extra bit of the show each week, you sometimes get it early if I can get it edited, you get it ad-free, and also you get invited to our exclusive patrons area of Discord. We also do a bonus show just for our gold members and above, of which we're about to record, I think it's episode 44.
Yeah, and we've subjected ourselves to playing some absolutely awful games, so this is going to be interesting.
Yeah, so if you want to join us on Patreon right now, you'll unlock all of those previous episodes as well. And of course, a big reason for doing it is to just support the podcast and make sure that we can keep bringing new episodes out. You can check that out at theretrohour.com to join our patrons community. So we've got a few extra stories on the way for the patrons in just a minute. Before that, though, let's take a quick second to give a massive thank you to a huge supporter of the Retro Hour podcast, and that is our wonderful friends at Shopify. And that is a sound that actually we've been hearing quite a bit of over the last couple of weeks, haven't we?
Yeah, I've set up the bookstore on Shopify, and we've been selling our books physical and digital as well, which is absolutely fantastic. You know, with the digital one, it just provides a download straight away. People buy it. It just works perfectly. And
automatically.
Yeah, automatically on the physical one, people can work out postage and, you know, I can print out all the labels and get that sorted. They get tracking on there. It's just absolutely fantastic.
I can't believe how easy it's been for us to do our book sales on Shopify, because I mean, we did originally a Kickstarter and we were saying that we wish Kickstarter had half of the features that Shopify has. It would have taken so much time out of the process of sending the books out initially. That's the thing about Shopify. They are the all-in-one commerce platform. And everyone's doing that at the moment. You know, it's not a bit of a side hustle. Might be becoming your own boss as well. Shopify allows you to start, run, and grow your business. And it's revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. And the good thing is, if you're selling in person, they also have those shop-ready point-of-sale systems.
Yeah, they're great. And of course, you know, for events, you can just have that and straight away get a sale.
Yeah, because that's the thing. No one carries cash anymore to events. So having these, if you're selling anything in person, really, really important. And of course, that incredible e-commerce platform, which we are absolutely loving. And they even get you selling across your social media marketplaces, you know, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok as well, full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth and giving you complete control of your business. And you'll testify this forever. You know, you don't need any new skills to use it. No coding, no design.
No, it's simple. And you can add a lot of stuff in there as well, which was great. You know, you can add some external applications in there like Printify, and it's just fantastic.
Yeah, so if you're selling anything at all, it is time to get serious about selling and get Shopify today. And when you do need it, you know, if you ever need a bit of help, they've got an extensive business course library and support available as well. So they're ready to support your success every step of the way. So if you'd like to try out Shopify for yourself, we've got you an incredible offer. You can try it out for just £1 a month. Now head to this link, shopify.co.uk/retrohour, all lowercase, all one word, no spaces, shopify.co.uk/retrohour. I'll put that in this week's show notes as well. And get ready to take your business to the next level today and hear a lot more of this. Right then, well, thank you for checking out the news on this week's podcast. We'll have more for you on next Friday's show. A little reminder that if you want to check out any of the stories that we've talked about, I do put the links to them all in the show notes on your podcast app, or you can click through directly from our website at theretrohour.com. We did mention that we do have still some books available as well on our Shopify store. I think at the time of recording, there are still some available. Ravi, you've got a bit of a backlog because you were in Sweden last week, but you're getting through those quickly. Yeah. Then we'll see how many we've got left, but there are still some Retro Hour books available at the moment. If you head to our website, theretrohour.com, like I said, we're not going to be doing any more prints, so I get them while they're hot. So if you want to get hold of a Retro Hour book, and thank you for all the nice feedback we've had from people who just got hold of them.
It was great having people bringing them up to sign in Norway and stuff. Really,
yeah,
nice.
It was really good. So if you want to get hold of one of our books, they are available right now for everybody to buy on our website in both their hardback and ebook formats at theretrohour.com. Right then, speaking of Norway last week, we were honoured to chat to legendary video game composer Yoko Shimomura, who worked on incredible games like Street Fighter 2, Kingdom Hearts, and lots more as well. And we're going to bring you that panel next on the Retro Hour podcast.
You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have Leaf Filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A Leaf Filter Trusted Pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install Leaf Filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, Leaf Filter Trusted Pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30%. 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Yes, so we have Yoko Shimomura from Japan. And can we get a big round of applause?
Welcome.
Of course, from great companies like Capcom and Square as well. Street Fighter 2, you know, Kingdom Hearts, Parasite Eve. We're going to be covering her career and how she started. So the first question we always ask our guest is, what was your first gaming experience?
The first experience of her gaming was at the supermarket. Uh-huh. And she played the baseball game with this tiny pictograms. She was waiting for her mom to shop at the supermarket. She was playing it with her dad.
Love to you were a pianist at a very young age. Were there any composers that influenced you?
So when she was going to the elementary school, she was in love with Chopin. And from her junior high, that's where she began to listen to Rachmaninoff. Her original experience of starting to play piano was when she was 5 or 6 years old, but it was actually an organ.
Okay.
Not a piano.
Then piano kyoshitsu de kayotte.
The piano was so expensive.
Yep.
That's why she had to play the organ.
Well, she ended up going to the Osaka College of Music. And I was wondering what made her want to enter the video game industry after that.
Well, first of all, she was in love with games, video games, as you like, as you guys like. And well, she was playing Super Mario Brothers, and she says she's not that good at playing, but she didn't give up playing, and it makes her want to try many times, even if it's not going working. That's, she says, the charm of video game. Then after the Super Mario Brothers, she met Dragon Quest. So she was impressed by the music, how classical, it's like classic music, the Dragon Quest is. And that's made her wanted to go into the video game music world.
Let's talk about Capcom.
Capcom.
How did you arrive at Capcom? And do you remember the job interview, what that was like?
Remembered very clear. So when she graduated from the school, the University of Osaka College of Music, she was finding her job, and there was no internet like this back then. There were a whole bunch of flyers on the wall, and there was one of them was from Capcom. The year before her graduation, so when she was a student at the college, she happened to work as a one of the staff at an event like this, and that was held by Capcom. And when she was at the interview, she was like, oh, I remember handing out the flyers at the event. That was the Ghosts and Goblins. Thank you. And she thought it was a fate.
Right.
Yeah.
Samurai Sword. Created on the Famicom disk system, which was exclusive to Japan. And it had a high fidelity audio channel. How was that? Was that used? And did you enjoy that system?
She says, even though it said they're using the hi-fi fidelity sound channel, but in fact, when they were creating games, they want enough memory to use.
Right.
So they were using the programming, SE, sound effects, then the music, and they have to make it into 800 hex, as she said.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what she was told was, make the music data as small as you can.
Not much memory
only
in those days, yeah.
Only two tracks.
Only two tracks for use.
Okay, yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
What kind of equipment were you using to produce the music at Capcom?
MSX-ni.
At Capcom, she was using a system called MSX.
Yeah.
Lots of people use it.
You know?
Yeah, MSX.
Yeah. Then she had to put the data in the Yamaha FM cassette.
Right.
Data tracked, not like a tape.
Yeah.
And then transport that data to Sony 8-bit system. That's how it worked.
Did she use any MIDI?
Back when she was creating, composing for Samurai Sword, she's not sure if there was MIDI already existed, but she couldn't use that back then. Not her skill-wise, but she didn't know it existed. So she was using the MML text files to create music.
Right.
So she had to type the program to be able to make the sound, say 80, comma, 3, comma, C. And that means how long the sound will be.
Okay.
The 80 is like 8 beat. Then 3 means how high the sound was. So it's like C.
Wow.
それを全部の音で書く。
Then C, which
one? 手でこうやって書いて。
All the notes, she had to do that for the same.
Wow.
今はとっても便利ね。
Now it's so convenient.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's talk about Street Fighter 2. When were you first aware of Street Fighter 2, and what was it like to work on your own solo project?
So when she started, before the project starts for the Street Fighter 2, she actually didn't know. It's like, okay, we're making this game and we need you to create it. It was more like she finished one project, then she had to choose one project from three choices. They had three titles, and Street Fighter 2 was one of the three. So schedule-wise, she picked this one, and this was Street Fighter 2.
Good choice.
そんなにヒットするなんて。
So back then, she didn't know it's going to be this huge smash hit. So if we knew that this game is going to be like this, then we will be fighting over the Street Fighter.
Yeah.
Well, with fighters from all around the world, how did you research the sounds and the melodies for the different countries?
So back then, as you know already, we had no internet. So she couldn't search, like, what kind of songs are they playing, or the instruments, what kind of instruments they're using in a different country. All she had was information from TV, or the Capcom has database. Mm. So that, then her father's record.
Oh, okay.
So those are the information she got. And she, from that, she soaked all of it and herself. Then she created the world.
Yeah, amazing.
So the Dalsim, he is the character from India.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
The people would say, oh, Indian, it's not like this, the music's not this, but she, it's her India in her head,
she
says. Now she feels sorry, gomennasai, to the Indian people, but first of all, India people doesn't go like in the first place.
So how long were they?
Were there any movies as well that were influenced?
Okay. For the movies, she herself is not movie person type so much, but her father really likes watching movies. So when her father is watching a movie on TV, she will be watching it together, and she got impressions, good impressions, and she's inspired by the music from the movies. But as Street Fighter wise, she didn't have any specific movies that she's influenced by. It's just all the world is coming from here.
So what are the considerations needed when composing for an arcade and a home game system, and are there differences?
When she was composing at the Capcom, her family computer, which is NES, mm-hmm. here, it's got only three tracks that she could use for the composing, the melodies, then plus noise. So very few choices she can make. But as for the arcade, she could use the FM, the sound. So she had eight tracks, which is five tracks more than mm-hmm. the family computer. Then she got even four more tracks for the drums. Total 12 tracks that she could use for the arcade. So she, all the sound-wise, she had a different techniques she had to use for each.
But you were also in the in-house Capcom band, Alpha Lila. Mm-hmm. So what was that like? And was it fun performing within the company?
Yeah, so desu ne. Tanoshi katta desu ne.
She had so much fun playing in Alpha Lila. Without that band, she might not have a chance to play in the band. And back then, she was living in Osaka because Capcom was in Osaka area. But then because of the band, she could be playing. Well, she could go to Tokyo to play in this big venues she knows, and the other game music band people from other companies got together. We played at the big venue in Tokyo. It was a whole lot of fun.
Of course, after Street Fighter II, role-playing game music became very famous for. I mean, why did that genre appeal to you, the RPG?
The best part about RPG game is that, like me, game player who sucks at action games can play through if you take your time. That's the best part. So when she was playing the Super Mario Brothers, she would get stuck and she would throw the controller. As for RPG game, she didn't think that would happen. But in reality, when her level is too low, she did it to the moment.
Was it fun taking the Super Mario world to RPG world?
As for creating and composing for the Super Mario RPG, the music that got her into the video game music industry is Super Mario Brothers. So she feels very intimidated a little bit to be able to arrange that song herself, a little A-W-E-L. But at the same time, she is very honored to be able to arrange the Super Mario music.
Well, after Capcom, you went to Square. So I was wondering, why did you leave Capcom and how did your career take you to Square? And do you remember the interview there?
So the why part of moving to Square was that, as you know already, she is bad at playing action games, she said. And she is originally a classic pianist. Mm. And she wanted to always compose for RPG like Dragon Quest with the piano classical sound. But then she got into Capcom, which is a good action game company. Mm-hmm. So she was dealing with the fact, creating the music. But then there was a chance that she had to move. Well, she was given a choice to move to within the Capcom company team, where she had to manage the sound system data instead of composing. And that made her worry that she would never be able to compose her songs. So she took it as a good chance to move to Square and do what she originally wanted to do, create a good classical RPG game music. That's the why part of going into Square. So at the interview, her interviewee was Mr. Uematsu, Nobu Uematsu. Then Akao Minoru is the sound programmer that's been working with Uematsu. Then Tokita Takashi, who is the director of Live Alive and scenario person of Final Fantasy IV.
Okay. Mm.
And those four interviewed her at Square Enix. And she doesn't remember what she's asked, but the name card that they gave to her, Uematsu-san and Akao-san, had a neat, pretty, clean name card. But then Tokita-san was like, dirty one. That's the only thing she could remember.
Why is it so dirty?
So her guess about the Tokita-san's dirty, dirty name card. It's Japanese culture. Yeah. When we meet at the first time, we always give in the name card. With the name and the emails.
They
didn't have email back then, just the numbers and stuff like that. Then her guess is that Uematsu-san and Akao-san, they are the people who meet people, interviews and everything. But Tokita-san is from the development programmers. And creators. So what they do is they don't meet people.
I think.
So her guess is that maybe Tokita-san's name card is in his name card holder forever.
Yeah.
That's what. That's what she remembers. And that means the interview was very nice with the kind of at home atmosphere, and everybody was nice.
I was wondering what she thought of European music with video games, and was she hearing more?
So as for the answer to your question, her impression of European music, the game music, was that she has grown up with the Japanese RPG games, so that's her most impression of game music. But when she did the arrangement for Minecraft and Smash Brothers, it was very interesting, she says. Since Japanese game music is more like melodic, it's got the like easy to understand, remember melodies, lines and stuff, so she's got the interesting impressions from that. And I actually did ask her an additional question from those three people at the interview that reminded of me Live Alive.
Right.
So I just asked her if it's they interviewed you for that project maybe, and she said yes.
Okay.
They were looking for a composer at Square Enix for that project. She didn't know that, but yes.
Oh, understood. Okay. Well, obviously, you mentioned about the limitations of the early systems, but when we got into like the PlayStation, CD-ROM, CD audio music, that changed a lot, I imagine, in terms of making music. And that did that free a lot of limitations up then?
She always hope for what she can do, what new things she can do when new hard is coming up as music-wise. And when PlayStation's out, as you said, there are more things they can do. They're using CDs and what you call streaming is now available on the system, I mean the hardware. But the Square policy, they have a policy, and they are the game company. They want the user to feel less waiting time for the loading. So what she was doing is the same. Less memory.
Less space on the disc.
Yes. Yeah. Don't use the streaming CD sound. Oh. Basically the same, she said.
Okay.
Well, I was wondering what the approach to bringing the novel Parasite Eve to video games was.
So, as for Parasite Eve, she researched herself reading the novel, original novel. Then the project started at Square Enix, and she...
It's so different!
So that's what happened. But then she watched the movie version of Parasite Eve, and before her original composing style is more like melodic, fantastic, moving music. But she watched the movie of Parasite Eve, and it's a horror movie. So she tried not to have this melodic, fantastic, her style. So she tried to be more like, not too melodic.
Right.
Doesn't bother the other systems and games.
But what was people's reaction to the idea of remixing the music? And what was it, a popular idea?
Yeah, there was a remix soundtrack that came
okay.
with it.
Mm-hmm. Actually, like Kingdom Hearts and stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. She feels happy that her music is remixed mm-hmm. or arranged. But then, yes, the fact that the people took time to remix or arrange her song, she feels honor to that. So that's the bass part. Then if it's a game that she is watching over for the arrangers, she would ask those people to fix some things as she checks and make it better. But then as the people playing her songs on YouTube and all that things, she's not watching over, but she's happy in the bass. Yes.
I was wondering why Kingdom Hearts was so special to you.
So what she said about Kingdom Hearts' uniqueness, the special, why is it special, is that she says all the games or everything she's composed for is special for her, and Kingdom Hearts is one of it. But one thing she said was that she did not have much chance to make a sequels to the game she's composed as sort of Mana, Legend of Mana. Mm-hmm. She's only composed that. She didn't for the others. And Parasite Eve as well, she composed for the one original. Then she didn't for two. Maybe it was a schedule-wise and everything else. But then at Kingdom Hearts, if it comes to Kingdom Hearts, she's been composing this title for the sequels and the rest, everything. Mm-hmm. So that's, if you put it as a special, yes, Kingdom Hearts is special that way.
Were Disney movies an influence on Kingdom Hearts soundtrack?
She watched the whole Disney films, but she didn't, well, she listened to the sound as well, but not only the sound, she would try to soak in this movie as a whole. So the movies, pictures, acting, and everything, including the music, and make that into the game she was trying to do. It's not only the music.
Oh, video game concerts are a very popular thing now. And what's it like seeing an orchestra playing your music? And you also did one with a guest, Chris Horsbeck, as well. What was that experience like?
How she feels about the concert. Well, long ago, her dream was to go to see abroad, outside of Japan. And she did pay her ticket to go to orchestral concert herself. So she liked doing both. But then when she got into the game music, she thought, oh, I've came to the furthest place for that as a musician. But then the time has passed, continuing her work in front of the PC.
Yeah.
that took her to her dream places, playing her musical, playing her orchestral concert and abroad, overseas. So that's making her happy. Every time whenever she goes outside of Japan for the orchestra concert, listening to the orchestra playing with the audience makes her think back the time when she was just dreaming all the things and making her dreams coming true in front of her eyes. That makes her cry all the time.
Well, we've talked about the past. Let's talk about the future. Is there anything you're working on, anything coming up?
So her plan for the future, she is actually having her Live Alive 30th anniversary concert in Japan. So if you're coming to Japan this weekend. She says. So besides that, she's been composing new songs. She can't tell which one right now, but she's been working. And the latest work she's done and it's released is called Renatus. That's her newest work. So if you have a chance to play that, please look for that, Renatus. But yeah, please look forward for the new works.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye. Exciting. So we've got time for some questions from the audience. Let's raise your hand and we'll come over with a mic.
Shimamura-san worked with Uematsu-san during her time in Square. How was that for as an experience?
So her experience working with Uematsu-san as a whole is that when back in the Square, well, now it's Square Enix, Uematsu-san is her boss at Square. But in Japan, it's a culture that you have to be very polite to the boss. You have to be nice to the boss. But Uematsu-san's not like this. He wouldn't ask for that. He was very friendly. And so she admired Uematsu-san as a composer. Then she learned one thing she learned from Uematsu-san is that as a composer working in a game company, he showed her to do what he wants in a company while working as a business composer. She showed her the way how to make her dreams come true in a company as a video game composer.
Fantastic. Who's next?
I was wondering, from all the Kingdom Hearts soundtrack you've made, do you have a clear favorite of the ones you've made?
She says lots of people will ask her the questions, but it's so hard to pick one. She feels her songs more like her child. So she can't pick. Okay, the older brother is fine, but not the youngest sister. She can't go like that. So yeah, she is saying she loves all the songs as her child.
Next question.
About 10 years ago, there was a campaign in the United States to change their national anthem to Guile's theme. How does Shimomura-sama feel about this? And also, quick question, what is her relationship to Edward Grieg?
She didn't know about the movement, but she's heard of she didn't actually see it, but she knows somebody told her that there was this another movement of Guile's theme that they're saying that Guile's theme would go with everything movement.
You know?
Do you know? So that they would play Guile's theme for every single different, situations, and that's proving that they're right. So that's what she's heard of, but first time of the anthem. Thank you.
Next question, please.
I was wondering, what were your favorite parts when composing the music for Parasite Eve?
The Parasite Eve composing stories. Okay. Back then when she was composing for Parasite Eve, she was living in Los Angeles because the Square Enix in Los Angeles was the project. They had the project for the Parasite Eve. So she had to live in Los Angeles. She says, as you can see, I can't speak so much English. So she tried her best living there. So the experience of living in Los Angeles was excellent. It was fun. It was not something that she can experience if she is working in a usual game company. So she's very, that was very impressive. Then, as for composing the Parasite Eve, it was like a puzzle, as she mentioned before. She was fighting in limited memories that she could use, then and limited tracks that she can use. She is only composing for the Parasite Eve. In the song she composed, there is a manipulator who would convert her compositions to a PlayStation system, and the manipulator there, the engineer, sound engineer kind of type job, said in Los Angeles, looking at her composition, says, "Is this a percussion orchestra you're composing?" And she never thought of her songs or like mentioned as that, because she's been playing piano, she's been listening and playing classic music, so she didn't intend, she didn't really think of percussion orchestra, but since the guy said, "Is it a percussion orchestra?" she realized that, oh, I might be using a lot. So that's her answer to that.
We have time for a couple more.
Hello. Konnichiwa.
Konnichiwa.
So I was wondering regarding composing video game soundtracks. Do you play the level first and then you're like, "Oh, I know what sound I what music I want to make," or do you make the music before you play the level?
Okay, her answer to your question is that when she is composing for games, there's no game. So the game's not made when she's composing. It says 90% of the game is not made when she starts creating. It's a parallel work that they're doing. So it's always she sees her music when after she composed on the game. So when she's creating it, she will get a text of what she needs to compose in the pictures and images and stuff. And from that, she creates the music. Thank you.
We have another?
Hello.
Hi.
I was thinking about when you have such great success with Street Fighter in the beginning and you got a lot of pressure on you after delivering the next game. How would you deal with the pressure? How does it affect your life? And what's your inspirations in your creative process?
Thanks for your question. The timing she knew that was a smash hit of Street Fighter 2 was very, very long later of the actual hit happened. She didn't have internet back then. She weren't able to get the feedbacks from fans soon. So she didn't know it was a hit. She was already on the next project at Capcom. At Capcom, people would start making a song right after the project ended. So she was already working on her next project. But if she knew that it's a smash hit, it would be a lot of pressure on her, she says.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have time for two more questions.
So, I haven't played Xenoblade Chronicles, but when I heard the main theme that you made, I really want to play. So I was wondering, do you have any special inspiration that you took for making that main theme from Xenoblade?
そうですね。なんかそんなにあのいろいろ。As for Xenoblade main theme, there was not much order when she starts making the composing for the song from the creators of Xenoblade. She just had the images of Xenoblade and request the saying, "Please use the piano as one of the instruments, the main instruments." So she composed song, then there were feedbacks two times. Can you make it more like moving? Move my soul? And she well, for the first, she did it. And she's got the another question saying the same thing, requesting the same thing. Can you move me more? So she did more. And now she's saying, I maxed out my moving you power so much. So now, how is it? Are you moved?
Okay.
Time for one more question then.
I was wondering, when you were composing music for the Disney worlds, if the Disney company had any comments or remarks, or if they were at all involved in the creative process, or if you had full freedom for composing the music.
Just checking. You mean Disney World is... We have this Super Nintendo game, like before, that's from it. Capcom, saying Disney Mickey's Magic Kingdom. What's it called in Japan? Kingdom Hearts.
Okay.
Thank you. Kingdom Hearts. The Kingdom Hearts'
music. ほぼないです。ほぼない。
As for the comment from Disney, they don't ask her much. They don't have requests too much of a request, but they are taking what she's made, but. They don't request much. They don't say much about her works. Thank you. Yeah, they approved. 認められてますね。
どうかな。そうだといいな。
I wish that, she says.
Well, they were great questions. Thank you very much, everybody. And please give a big thank you to Yoko Shimomura.
Thank you.
ありがとうございました。